Rewind the dynamite from the most wrestling site. AEW, lighting up the fuse. Sit back and enjoy the bubbly. As we hear from John and Waitay. Where we're going, we don't need roads. And if the buck stops here, this thing might blow. Everything you hear, opinions of the show. And if you don't like it, go to the forums and let them know.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Fright Night edition of Rewind to Dynamite. I am John Pollock, joined by Wei Ting. Hello, Wei.
How you doing, John? Love your costume.
Thank you. Likewise. I mean, for the people that are only listening to the podcast version of this,
boy, oh man,
you should really check out
the
video.
You don't usually put effort into your outfit, but this year, I mean, why the change?
Did you know it was me?
I could barely tell. Yeah.
You know what I am gonna go as Halloween?
What's that? Okay, that definitely is a joke that only works for video. But all right.
How are you?
I'm good. I'm good. I'm doing all right. Yeah. How about yourself?
Did you get outside today?
I did. I had to take my son to his flu shot.
Ooh.
So I was very nervous about that. And I had to do that by myself. Usually, like, you know, the mom's there and, like, we could kind of, like, you know, tag team the situation. So I was left with him, a two-year-old getting his flu shot. And I was prepared for the worst. Like, I had all this stuff ready. You know, I had, like, extra toys. I had, like, you know, videos loaded on my phone just to, like, distract him because I was expecting the worst. Took the shot, had, like, one scream, and that was kind of it.
Oh, that's good.
He took it like a champ, yeah. So
needles suck for kids. They just hate them.
I hate them. I'd be crying more than him.
I don't know. I never had a thing for needles. Like, I never had an issue with needles.
Do you watch The Needle?
Yeah, I do.
You do? Wow, yeah. You're one of those sickos.
Yeah.
Damn.
I don't know. I just, that was never a hang up for me. It was it's just like a little pinch. But yeah, they suck. I wish that they came up with like some digestible tablet that you could give kids that could give them immunity from all of these diseases, but we're not there yet.
Yeah, and I don't know if we will be. I don't know.
I don't think that's how science works, at least not yet. So.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure.
Well, I'm glad to hear Oscar is flu-free for the winter season.
Hopefully, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And you are going up for Halloween tomorrow.
Yes, we're going to be taking him. Yeah, well, like probably, I don't know, like five houses. Like,
does he know what Halloween is? Does he kind of? Can you sense an excitement for him? He understands it.
I don't know if I sense excitement. We have been teaching him to say trick or treat. Like, we've been reading him books about Halloween. So I think he has some awareness, but I don't exactly know if he knows what the tradition is, or if there's enough to be excited about.
Yeah, I did that with Max. He's definitely of a certain phase at age 7, where I asked him, like, what are you going to say? He's like, trick or treat, or, I'm like, or what? Or I'll kill you. I was like, let's not say that to random scourges at the door. Probably not the best idea. So
He's being extra creative. I mean, it's sort of, you want to be scary, and that would scare me, somebody walking up to my door and saying that to me. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that is Halloween to those that celebrate coming up. You're not dressing up tomorrow, I assume, are you?
I don't think so. No. What about you? You're already dressed up, of course. So
I might put on a hat.
Okay.
Might go all out. Well, tonight on the show we have Fright Night Dynamite to discuss, and a lot happening on this show. Everything from debuts, returns, and shredding documents.
No, yes, didn't.
This could be my favorite worst angle in a long time. Anything where documents are being shredded, I think. That's all coming up, but let us go into a couple of news items. Way, I spent a lot of time today talking about WWE ID, which WWE put out a press release on Tuesday announcing the launch of a first-of-its-kind developmental program designed to provide up-and-coming independent wrestlers a pathway to a potential career in WWE. The program will be called WWE ID, short for WWE Independent Development. Following the 2021 launch of their NIL program, WWEID has been constructed to support independent wrestling prospects and wrestling schools with world-class training, development, and mentorship. Under the program, WWE will provide prominent independent schools with the ID official designation with the goal of providing new trainees and existing talent at these select institutions with enhanced developmental opportunities, naming the first five schools Booker T's Reality of Wrestling, Cody Rhodes' Nightmare Factory, Seth Rollins' Black and Brave Academy, Elite Pro Wrestling Training out of Concord, New Hampshire, and the Knox Pro Wrestling Academy in L.A. Additionally, WWEID will identify top independent wrestling prospects with an official WWEID prospect designation and support their developmental journey by providing financial opportunity and assisting with training, mentorship, and development. Goes on, they plan to, you know, shoot footage involving these talents and provide behind the scenes content and use their social platforms to promote these talents. What are just some of your thoughts on this initiative by WWE and the impact it could have on the independent level when it comes to kind of cultivating talent much earlier in their development phase than, you know, currently where you may be X amount of years in before you get signed to an NXT contract?
I'm certainly interested in seeing what the results are. I've read some of the feedback to it, most of it very negative, and most of it, I think, very of concern from audiences worried about this having a similar effect to what the WWE UK project did to the UK scene. I have to think this time around they are conscious and aware of their mistakes with WWE UK. So I am more interested to see what they would do this time around when you can argue the stakes are even bigger, you know, being maybe more of a North American based sort of like project. What are they going to do to avoid some of that negative press that at least, you know, for the UK audience that they seem to have garnered quite a bit of? It's not in their interest to feel like, you know, the sort of corporate, I guess, entity that's there to take over the indies. And I don't think that that's what this intent is. What are they going to do that that will I avoid that sort of reputation? I wonder, are they even sensitive to it? I guess these are sort of my biggest questions.
I have a lot of questions about it. That's why I don't think you can necessarily make a judgment call on this. This will be borne out, and I think it's going to be the independent promoters and trainers and talent that are going to see this. There's obvious benefits are the fact that you're going to have talent that are at least going to have some of their income from WWE, and that's helpful to them. The question will also become of how much, like, WWE is not just doing this out of the goodness of their heart. They obviously see that here is this independent ecosystem that if we can get to some of these performers at an earlier stage, that we don't want them necessarily coming to the performance center, and either we have to untrain bad habits or make that adjustment. We want that to be kind of sorted out before they walk in the doors at the performance center. And I mean, with that, like, that's a lot easier said than done when it comes to like where WWE is going to be tailoring these schools towards how they are taught, what they are shied away from. Are there companies they want them to stay away from? Are there match types that they don't want these talents taking part in that they feel would be a bad image for them if you have got these people out there with, I mean, will you be literally wrestling with a WWE logo on your tights? Like, maybe it's not going to be that intrusive, but you're going to have your people out there and, you know, certain angles, maybe they don't want them doing anything risque, or just there could be all these different issues when it comes to a talent that you do have under a deal, under this branding, and how it's going to form a control over parts of how the independent system works. And it naturally puts AEW into a situation where we're all looking for this talent, and we have to have a plan of going after these talents as well. So it's not a case of just waving these, what we can probably imagine, this is not going to be life-changing money that these performers are going to be making, but in their current state, I'm sure it's going to be more than welcome that they're going to have some kind of subsidy as it goes towards this, what is really a passion for them to try and pursue this career.
I would also assume having that WWE label attached to you would probably improve your likelihood of getting bookings. Maybe,
of course, just especially if there's going to be the shot of it showing up on their YouTube channel or any social platforms. Mm-hmm. I think it will entice you to book these people with the idea that there could be WWE cameras running, or just having that attachment as, you know, WWE ID prospect. This guy is going to be like, you can put that WWE logo on your poster, essentially.
Yeah. And it's actually provides great material for whoever's facing a WWE ID wrestler, for them to cut a promo on, you know, a WWE ID guy. So maybe you can look forward to some of those.
We get a whole group of guys that are like a faction and they come out like wearing barcodes.
Okay. The IDs.
The IDs.
The idiots.
Is that already being thrown out there?
I don't know. I'm not sure. Yeah. I mean, listen, I'm open to seeing what this is before I make any sort of judgment. I'm also curious to see like what effect it has on some of these schools and whether or not other affiliate schools become, you know, are going to be named. Of course they are, right? But do you see this being like maybe a similar idea to maybe what they used to have with like, you know, Deep South and OVW and HWA, or do you see this being maybe a deeper relationship than even that?
I mean, I think that the fact is they've rolled out 5 schools. Like, that's already, you know, at their, when developmental was being, you know, its grandest focus, you had UPW, you had HWA, and then you had OVW. And I mean, granted, those were actual like running promotions on top of it beyond just being schools. But in this one, you have 5 schools. It would not surprise me if promotions follow from this that get some kind of designation with WWE. But I mean, I don't think it's going to stop at 5 schools. Like, and if you're looking for many schools out there that are going to be offered something. Now, I want to play some of this that Brandon, he's reported a lot of new details on. We are not aware of any financial support yet that these schools are getting. But if you have these designations and you spread it across all of these gyms and it's suddenly, you know, you're getting WWE into how these people are being trained from day number one. Yeah, over time, that is certainly going to have a residual effect, I would think, on the industry, where it's, you know, certain ways like we don't do this and this is how we do this, which I'm always leery of in pro wrestling. I don't believe in a right way, wrong way. It's kind of this is your way. And there are many ways to this industry, but this is certainly creating the illusion of a very direct pipeline going to people that, you know, from day one, if you're walking into the Black and Brave Academy, well, there's a very direct pipeline and mm-hmm. you're probably not going to that school with the idea of AEW being the goal or New Japan being the goal, but rather like WWE is the preferred destination if I'm successful in this field.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, you can argue maybe a lot of people who already signed up to these schools already have that in mind. But ultimately, it'll be up to whether or not the WWE sees that in you. And a lot of these schools are still going to produce talents that will get picked up by, you know, another promotion that's not the WWE as well. Did you want to go through some of those details from?
Yeah. So this is from today's Pollock and Thurston. And I just want to play this because Brandon did a lot of reporting on this. So here are some details that Brandon has learned about the ID.
Only mentioning schools, now you could look to Reality of Wrestling, Booker T's school, which is also a promotion. But at this point, they're only working with schools, not yet working with promotions. I've been informed that there is no financial support even yet going to these schools. But multiple sources have informed me that there are some independent wrestlers already who are under contracts related to this program. And we haven't been able to identify yet who those wrestlers are, but it has been confirmed to us by multiple sources that there are indie wrestlers who are taking indie bookings, and they're quietly at this point under deals. I think it is possible that we'll see in the future, we'll see some announcements about who is under a deal related to this program. But one source who's close to the program informed us that there are currently no restrictions on these indie wrestlers to work for what promotions they can't work for or whether they can lose. One motivating factor, I believe, here is that this program will help them reduce their antitrust risk, which is something that I think this company and this parent company, TKO, are very conscious of, given MLW sued WWE last year. The lawsuit was settled at the end of the year for $20 million. And UFC's in a lot tougher situation with their two antitrust lawsuits. One of them's got a preliminary approval for $375 million. The Kung Lee case, the Johnson case, is still being worked on. So I'm sure this is something that TKO is being very conscious of. They do not want to become a target for antitrust litigation, whether that's civil lawsuits from other businesses or even the federal government. This is pretty clear that this is something that has happened now as part of new leadership taking over WWE. This is not something you would have seen in the Vince McMahon era. But I'm told that, Paul Levesque is very supportive of this idea, and Nick Khan is in favor of the strategy.
Yeah, I didn't imagine this one being an initiative of Vince McMahon one day showing up and stating, you know what? We are not paying enough attention to the Pacific Northwest. Look at these Defy shows.
It actually all sounds to me like it might be a version of the NIL program, but directed towards professional wrestling, the independent pro wrestling scene. Or, I mean, I get this, like, from what I understand, the NIL program is essentially WWE sponsoring a lot of these athletes monetarily through their, careers, and kind of taking dibs on them for when they're done entering their system. This seems like it might be similar, where they are taking dibs on perhaps, independent wrestlers that are out there that show potential, so that maybe by the time that they feel that they're ready, they will enter their system.
Yeah, and I think like that goes to the history that there's, I think, always been. I think this has changed over time, but I still feel like there is not a dismissal of the independents, but this belief that there's a lot of bad habits picked up that we have to retrain the performers. And as Paul Levesque has stated, learn from our playbook. And I think this kind of goes to that. Now, you look at some of the performers that have really that helped NXT establish itself and later becoming main roster stars. Well, a lot of these people were extremely successful independent stars and came in with that.
There's still quite a few of them in modern day NXT.
Yeah. But I think this is still to that point of we get to them earlier. They're not going to develop what we perceive as bad habits, and you're going to get to them that much earlier in their careers, and we're going to steer them. And by the time they walk into the door, they're already going to have received attention from our media that, part of that is already done. Because
sure,
the counter argument is that you wouldn't have to spend any of this money. Like, let them develop on someone else's dime on the independents. And then when they are seasoned enough, then you pluck them up and go to Florida. But their belief is like, we don't want to be getting them 4 years into their development. We want to be getting them even earlier and, pretty much developing them from like their very embryonic stages.
I would say like the Performance Center probably just doesn't have the resources in order to take as many people as they might see potential in. And I think there's always the argument that when you're just within that WWE developmental Performance Center system, you're not getting enough experience wrestling outside. This allows them to develop. I think they would admit themselves that there are things about the independent wrestling system that have worked, that have helped them develop, as like talent as amazing as like a, Kevin Steen or Sami Zayn or, whatever, CM Punk. That they probably want to retain, but maybe with a bit more of a guiding hand so that they can really make it work for them. So we'll see what they can do.
Yeah, and my last point, and I brought this up today, is that going the NIL route, like, yes, you are signing like tremendous athletes, but it's way more of a crapshoot about, like, it takes a very special person to understand this industry and what it takes to succeed at wrestling. It's sort of its own thing. And I think you're going to have a way higher success rate from the independents in terms of people that, okay, they may not be the athlete of this NIL recruit, but what they make up for is they are probably a fan of this industry before they ever step foot into a gym, and they understand this industry and have an affinity for WWE that like you want to marry the two ideally, but I think like that is something you miss out on if you sort of discount the independence, which a few years ago it felt like that was what WWE was all but closing the door on. This is quite the adjustment to that philosophy. All right, we will continue on and chat a little bit. We're not going to go too much into this, but PWInsider.com did have a story about Vince McMahon potentially launching a new entertainment company. No better timing than now for Vince McMahon to really create that next act in his career. Rumored to be involved with this would be former WWE executives Brad Blum and Kristen Prouty. This would not be anything attached to professional wrestling. Rather, this would be financing and producing film and television projects, fiction and nonfiction vehicles. And today, Kendra Barkoff-Lamy, who is the spokesperson for Janelle Grant at SKDK, put out a statement. Both on and off the camera, Vince McMahon has built a reputation for his violent outbursts, sexual deviance, manipulation, and abuse. No one who cares about survivors and justice should want to work for or with any company of McMahon's. He needs to be held accountable for the heinous acts he committed against Janelle Grant and others at WWE, end quote. So Vince McMahon has not commented on this, nor has any of his spokespeople that we have reached out to yet. It is of no surprise that Vince McMahon wants to resume a career in any field. Will this be able to get off the ground and be successful? He certainly has the capital to do so. And I never discount when people have significant amounts of money, people will be willing to work for you. I think that's very clear. So I don't think anyone should be holding up a moral compass to the idea of Vince McMahon being able to get business for such a venture if he's willing to go forward with this. However, that is not going to stop a federal investigation, which is in the midst of being conducted, nor a civil suit that ends its stay in December.
I think seeing how big this can get will be quite telling of about how much people seem to care about this Vince McMahon story. You know, how much has his name really been tarnished if he is able to make this entire thing a success? Because I could tell you if, like, it was, I don't know, like a Harvey Weinstein trying to, like, if he maybe wasn't in jail, like, if he could actually, you know, start something, I don't know how many people would sign on. But a Vince McMahon, I could still see, even at this point, weaving through the cracks and not getting enough attention that people would just, like, maybe turn a blind eye to something like this. You know, prove me wrong, world, but, like, this guy still thinks he can, you know, operate, I guess, and he has not been arrested for any reason. So maybe he just, you know, he has money and feels like this is what he, at least close enough to his wheelhouse, that he's willing to pay for it.
Kenny Omega is going to be appearing at Power Struggle this Monday, and it definitely feels like a return is very imminent, and we'll be getting into that with a strong tease of Kenny Omega in the tag title match by the Young Bucks. But yes, he will be appearing on Monday. I was very curious if we would get maybe more than just a passing reference to Kenny Omega tonight, because typically when someone is ready to come back in the AEW sphere, it's usually AEW that wants to have that person first, but it does look like Omega will make this appearance Monday before any AEW return, where we haven't seen him since that angle to take him out back in March. But obviously things seem to be trending towards that Wrestle Dynasty show on January 5th and Kenny being involved. You know, they've already put out the video of him and Hiroshi Tanahashi, so the seeds have been planted, and I would expect a big angle here on Monday.
I'm curious, like, all signs point to Wrestle Dynasty being, you know, the Bucks with Kenny versus Kenny and Hiroshi Tanahashi. Now, I'm curious to see how much AEW will be recognizing and promoting Wrestle Dynasty. You know, Forbidden Door is one thing. It's a show that they are producing. But Wrestle Dynasty, I'm sensing, is a New Japan show. What are the, like, where do you even watch Wrestle Dynasty? Will it be a New Japan World show? Will it be something that you can order on Triller, like other AEW pay-per-views? So how much...
And it's also 1 week after World's End. So it's not like you have this several-week period to focus on that as a pay-per-view. Like, you have World's End December it's the last weekend of December, and then January 5th is Wrestle Dynasty. So it's like you have a 1 week turnaround, and I feel like it's going to, well, we're going to see how effectively, but this is kind of like your all in, all out scenario, but this is not necessarily going to be, I think it's very clear World's End is going to be the show they are hyping up the most in December.
But judging by, what we've already seen from the Bucks addressing Kenny Omega, what we saw tonight with them delivering the V-trigger and also One Winged Angel in their match, I would assume that a lot of the storytelling leading up to either this debut at Wrestle Dynasty or prior to it will be taking place on AEW television, probably imminently, or whenever the Bucks are choosing to, they're saying they're working from home, whatever that's supposed to mean. Are we going to see them? Are we not going to see them for a while? But their next storyline seems to be with Kenny Omega.
Yeah, and just looking at this card for Monday, it's Power Struggle with Zack Sabre Jr. and Shingo Takagi in the main event for the IWGP title, and then Shota Umino and Sonata second from the top. And you would think coming out of this show that we'll have a pretty clear idea of what that January 4th main event is going to be, and if it is in fact going to be Shota Umino, which has been hinted at after him and Takagi both got wins over Zack in the G1. Shane Haste and Mikey Nichols against Hanare and Great O'Conn for the IWGP tag titles. The finals of the ongoing Super Junior Tag League will take place. Master Wato is back, challenging Doki for the junior heavyweight title. David Finlay against Taichi for the global heavyweight title. And Evil and Ren Narita against Hiroshi Tanahashi and Oleg Bolton, who is replacing El Fantasmo. Very good card on Monday so far. I think this is going to be a very strong show, but this is beyond any of the matches. I think it's setting the scene for Wrestle Kingdom coming out of this show. That should be the key stuff on the show and whatever Omega's doing.
Yeah, I expect a big angle, maybe a big, more than one big announcement, hopefully.
All right, we're going to go to ratings now because I want to segue after NXT to what they have planned next week. But Raw, both Raw and NXT got hammered against the World Series in the demo. On Monday, Raw did 1,401,000 viewers and a 0.43, which was its lowest demo audience since the Best Of show last Christmas, when Christmas landed on a Monday. This was a very intense night because you had Game 3 of the World Series that did 13.2 million viewers on Fox and another 429,000 on Fox Deportes, plus the Giants-Steelers game that did 13.3 million viewers across ABC, ESPN, and ESPN2. So it was an exceptionally tough night competition-wise, but that demo, their lowest of the year. And then NXT last night went against Game 4, and this produced 588,000 viewers and a 0.14. So it was their lowest audience, excluding the sci-fi shows this summer, since July the 2nd, and lowest 18 to 49 audience since the 4th of July, 2023. So this was a big hit that they took, which is usually not the case. Usually NXT is impervious to anything. These people, they live and die for their NXT, and nothing is going to take them away from those 2 hours. But the World Series did. There was also an NBA game going against them. But that does set up next week, where they will be airing on Wednesday night, the night after the election, with the ECW reunion, the tried and true format for a promotion to come back. And they have announced Bubba Ray Dudley teaming with Trick Williams against Ethan Page and Ridge Holland. Rob Van Dam, who is going to be doing something next week, as he announced in this segment with Javon Evans in this big pull apart with Wesley. We have Francine appearing, and we have Dawn Marie so far. And Little Guido will be doing something with Tony D'Angelo. That I actually think will be pretty entertaining with D'Angelo. And that should be the goal. It was like, find these people that have a natural character to play off of the NXT generation. And I'm sure there are going to be plenty of other names that they're going to add and just make this a full ECW nostalgia 2 hours next Wednesday.
Yeah. I find it really interesting how NXT is able to use nostalgia, whether it be in the form of like their PLE names and gimmicks, like, you know, spin the wheel, make the deal, or in this case, ECW nostalgia, in order to use it to promote their next generation. So I think you're going to see that contrast in every single segment that might involve an ECW original. And I look forward to seeing what some of those results are. I'm hoping the match is Rob Van Dam versus Javon Evans. I think that would be great for Javon Evans. It'd be great for RVD, honestly. And I actually feel like they did a great job of maybe turning whatever skepticism might have existed about the Bully Ray involvement into something that they somehow Jedi mind tricked this audience into actively wanting. I think all they needed to do was have Bully say, "I'm not here to take a spot from somebody." And then, you know, everybody's like, "Oh, he's such a nice guy. See, he's not here to take a spot." And in doing so, I thought they went about it in a clever way to make the audience at least want to cheer for him and want to see this tag team match with Trick Williams.
So are we going to get a flaming table at the end?
That's very doubtful. I don't know if that would pass the WWE ID.
Probably not.
Qualifications.
No, probably not. So anyway, that is next week, and we'll talk about what Dynamite is going to be combating them with. Do you see a Wednesday night of the audience shifting to the different night? This is the opposite of what AEW had to contend with, going to the opposite night. How do you think that's going to impact the NXT audience? And do you think that the lineup they have so far, we should mention the fact they also did, they set up a 10-woman tag for next week, including Jordan Grace, who's going to be on the babyface side. So they have three matches announced so far.
I think this is it's going to be a much more interesting fight, if you want to call it that, because whereas I think NXT was doing really well and Dynamite was sort of the invading promotion on a foreign night, I feel like it was a pretty easy call to say that NXT was going to win this one. Here you're dealing with AEW at its home territory, but NXT being incredibly hot, you know, at least, I mean, you know, in some of the momentum that they've been building, plus they're like making a big effort in promoting this nostalgia heavy show. I think it'll be much more even, but I still see AEW just maybe out of habit, you know, probably winning the night, but I think the gap will be far closer than it was for the Tuesday one.
Yeah. The X factors, there will be no World Series to have to deal with, but like there's a very, very solid chance that there will not be a decisive winner in the election from the night before. And even if there is, all the news programming is going to be gigantic next Wednesday, the night after the election. So you do have that to contend with. We will see. NXT usually stuns me when it comes to real world events and how their audience holds up. So we are going to see. Like, they are playing the nostalgia card, and I think that is going to have a ton of interest from people, because that tends to work really well.
Yeah, yeah. So Dynamite, we should maybe just say what they've announced so far. We have the Learning Tree versus the Conglomeration in a fight without honor. Adam Cole versus Malakai Black. Darby Allin and Orange Cassidy taking on Claudio and Pac. And then we have Penelope Ford versus Jamie Hayter.
Which is a good lineup. I don't think there's any one match there that is your, like, blow you out of the water blockbuster match that they are throwing at you. I think they're going to have a very good show wrestling wise, but I don't see the big hook that NXT is clearly aiming at people with the ECW nostalgia. And what they're very good at is, you've announced these names, you know, you're going to get cameos and surprises probably next week. That, again, you introduce those in the segments and it kind of keeps people hooked of who else is showing up, and they could have a Sandman, they could have a Tommy Dreamer, you know, all these different figures. I would imagine they're going to make this a very heavy ECW night.
Yeah. As silly as it sounds, I think having these sort of special titles attached to these TV shows, like, it's significant. You know, I think tonight, for instance, Fright Night Dynamite, it's not just the name, but like the name does add something. And I think it signals to the audience that this is going to be a special edition of the show that you shouldn't miss next week. You know, we'll see what kind of card they give us by Wednesday, but nothing really jumps out at me. Like Cole versus Black. Yeah. It's going to be a great match between like two black and gold, guys, but it doesn't even feel like they're trying to fan those flames so much. It at the moment with these four matches just kind of feels like a pretty typical edition of Dynamite.
How about this? AEW invades New Hampshire.
Okay.
Does that have a ring to it?
I don't know. No.
Manchester, New Hampshire. Not a whole lot of nostalgia in that venue.
No.
The last thing I wanted to note was just the latest on the UFC antitrust case, because John Nash, who has been like the reporter covering this entire antitrust suit. I would very much encourage people to be following his work at Hey Not the Face. He does run a Substack, and he interviewed the lawyers for the plaintiffs. He had Eric Kramer and Michael DelAngelo on his program. He has put it up for free as well if you want to listen to this. Won't go through everything here, but some of the keynotes. Again, the settlement is for $375 million just for the Kung Lee class, which is fighters from December 16th of 2010 through June 30th of 2017. That works out to approximately 1,100 fighters that are going to be receiving a payout pending the final approval by Judge Boulware. There is a hearing set for February 6th, and you would think in theory that, you know, he's made the preliminary approval, and unless something goes awry, this should be rubber stamped February 6th. And then there will be several months where claim forms are sent out. Fighters are just essentially already, you know, this was mentioned on the show that, like, these fighters, now that they are this close to this money, you're hearing about people that are just trying to talk them into, oh, well, you need someone to look over this. It's, you know, people are out just to get like a chunk of this cash, and they're making it very clear. You are getting this money. It's not a complex provision that you have to go through. Like, you just need to sign off on this. Sure, get a lawyer to look over it if you need to, but this is pretty straightforward. You are owed this money. You should not be forking over any of it to managers or anything like that. But the breakdown that they had here, so 800 fighters will receive more than $50,000, 500 fighters receiving over $100,000, 100 fighters will get over $500,000, and there's 35 fighters that will get over $1 million. One thing that I haven't heard brought up, but it's worth throwing this out there. Brock Lesnar is going to be paid in that million plus range. And if you're looking at this last year and change that he has not wrestled, like, this might just be the send off of, like, Brock was never in a position where he needed to continue wrestling, but he's about to get a seven-figure amount from this class. He had two fights under the Cajun Johnson class, but I would think, like, this is the one where he's going to get the most from. And I don't think this is going to be an insignificant seven figures either. Anderson Silva stands to make about $10 million. So, you know, Brock is going to be of that upper percentage in terms of what he's going to get here. That this, if there was any thought of a Brock Lesnar return, like, this might have just been quietly like, this guy is set, and here's a very unexpected lump sum that is coming your way that you probably were not anticipating, you know, at his age. And
who else is in that class that might be relevant for a professional wrestling? Like, is Ronda in there?
Ronda's in that class. Tom Lawler is in that class as well. I think Tom Lawler has done the math of the money. I can't remember the figure off the top of my head, but this is not like insignificant money for these people that they're going to be getting. And Tom had a lot of fights during that period. Like, he was on The Ultimate Fighter in 2008, and he fought there until 2017. So all of his fights actually were under the Kung Lee period. So like a George St. Pierre, a Ronda Rousey, like, these are what, like, they're going to get a lot. Connor had a lot of big fights during that pre 2017 period.
Yeah. Not to really like get so deep into this, but I like, you brought up earlier about like the idea of managers and other people who might get involved. Are there situations where managers would be entitled to some of this? If we're talking about, you know, percentages of fight purses, would this be considered a fight purse.
It's not a fight purse. Like, this is a class action lawsuit that I don't. Your manager did nothing to procure this money for you. Nothing. Like, if anything, you should be, you know, and the lawyers also, like, they need to be approved for this figure, but they're aiming to get around 31% of that $375 million. And I know there is a lot of, like, naturally people just have an aversion to lawyers getting paid, but they did cite here that they spent $12 million over these 10 years. And, like, you're taking this on contingency. Like, there was the chance these lawyers could have spent 10 years of hiring all these experts, of fighting this case, and they could have walked away with nothing. So, yeah, they are going to get their fair share in this thing entirely. But fight managers, like, they did nothing to get this money for their clients. Their clients are getting this directly to them. The managers are not entitled to anything here. Like, I understand if that person is the go-between to secure your next contract, to negotiate your next fight, there is labor being produced for the fighter, for the client, and you are hiring them for those services. This is not that. Like, this is a fighter that competed, and it is, like, that is
what if there was a contract that the manager had that said, whatever you earn between this period and this period, I get this percentage?
Well, I don't think any of that would hold up in this case, but you are going to get plenty of that. There are going to be plenty of managers that are going to be trying to get percentages of these payouts, because these are noteworthy payouts. That
managers
these guys,
slash trainers, you know, like people that are just sort of in the realm of whatever makes a fighter a fighter.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, all of this can be read at UFCFighterClassAction.com. And I really hope fighters just like you have, like Sam Alvey stating last week, like, I didn't even know I was part of a lawsuit or anything like that. Like, you don't have to opt into this. You are automatically figured in. You have to actually opt out of it if you don't want this money. But you are already entitled, if you fought during this period, to this money. And I believe I heard one fighter opted out, and that was Rory Markham, I believe. But the other 1,100.
What was his reason?
I don't know what his reason was for it. Interesting. But that was the one name that had.
So what if you don't collect? Like, what if you're not aware?
There's going to be some of those fighters that are either not going to respond to this or not make the claim. What happens is the money left over all gets put into a pool, and it's dispersed among the other fighters. It doesn't go to the lawyers. It doesn't go back to the UFC. It then the other fighters receive that. So if, say, 100 fighters don't claim
the deadline for that.
They haven't set the clear deadlines yet, but it'll probably be around June or July. Once you get the claim form, it's like 45 days to get that back, where you just confirm your information, how many fights you had, mm-hmm. what your bout purse was, and what money you're entitled to.
And if, and just to maybe, because we're already this deep into it, deceased fighters, do you know, like, what? If they're in
that wasn't brought up, but I would think that the estate then would have the ability to benefit from that. That's my understanding.
And hopefully those people are aware of their right to claim, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. This one website is kind of been out there for all of these fighters to just be enrolled and get all the notifications and emails. But, like, there is some activity that needs to be done by the fighters to be aware of this, because it could be serious money for you when you're talking about, like, most are going to be getting at least $50,000. Like, 800 mm-hmm. of the 1,100 are getting at least $50,000. So, all right, that's the latest there. And I also want to promote the Chris Bay GoFundMe that is up. They are trying to raise $100,000 for him as he's recovering from neck surgery, and already he has raised, the last time I checked, it was over $77,000. TNA is also going to be holding an auction on November 8th at whatnot.com at 2 p.m. A bunch of talent are donating items, so they're going to hold an auction with the proceeds going to Chris Bay. And
Pro Wrestling Tees released a shirt, too.
That's right. Yes. If you want to go check out Pro Wrestling Tees, they have put out the We Love Bay shirt as well. All right. Extended news pack, but let us go to tonight's edition of Dynamite. But you know what I always say? When the business is back, we don't want your online business to be impacted. Don't let bad choices online lead to your business being hurt.
Right about now is probably when many of you are stressing about those end-of-year travel plans. Don't make things tougher for yourself by waiting till the last minute to consider data options for your phone. Hunting for SIM cards at the airport is time-consuming, while roaming fees from your home provider can be expensive. There's a much better option for international data these days, and that's with an eSIM service like Saily. Saily provides mobile data in 160 countries at affordable prices. It's easy to install, and you could do it right from home. Just download the app on your eSIM-enabled phone, pick a data plan that suits your needs, and follow the steps to install. No more swapping SIM cards or worrying about surprise charges. Saily plans come with 24/7 chat support if you run into any issues. Plus, since it's created from the team behind NordVPN, you can feel secure about your connection. To get an exclusive 15% off your Saily purchase, go to saily.com/postwrestling or download the Saily app and use code POSTWRESTLING at checkout. The link is in the description of this podcast. Stay connected and travel smart this holiday season with Saily.
Spoken like a professional voiceover actor himself. Way too. Great job. To Fright Night Dynamite tonight, Way, the Wolstein Center in Cleveland, Ohio. Around 3,200 tickets distributed, according to WrestleTix. And we had our Halloween-themed opening. I did like the overall Halloween theme that they attached to this show. And we had a bit of a different opening where we thought we were getting the usual BCC carnage and new promo, but it is immediately shut down by Orange Cassidy, who is live in the arena and comes down to address the BCC and their attack on Chuck Taylor last week, where they, quote, crushed his neck with a steel chair. And he looked around the ring, surrounded by the future of AEW, who have no idea the danger they are in or how dangerous Moxley is. And he said that if it wasn't for AEW, there would be no Orange Cassidy. He would not exist, which I think is a little hyperbolic right there. I mean, the man would be alive if it wasn't for AEW.
Would the character exist, I guess?
Yes. I mean,
it would be, exist.
Do you think it would be potential candidate?
I don't know. I don't know if WWE ID would be touching this one. This is a guy that I really don't know if I would have ever seen him receive any sort of shot in the WWE.
Odds are, it would have been tougher for him certainly without an AEW. But older than people think at 40. Certainly doesn't.
Well, maybe
look
that's
it.
What he means. I mean, yeah. He might have retired. He might have quit the business if not for AEW.
So the fans all cheer this that they need AEW, and he's going to cut the head off the snake in order to protect everyone, and challenges John Moxley for the AEW championship. He's going to take it out of Moxley's bag and put it into his backpack. So that was our opening segment. This was a very, very rare Orange Cassidy promo, probably the lengthiest one that he has done. I mean, he's done promos in the past, but not as significant as this, opening the show, and is obviously going to be headlining the next pay-per-view. How did you feel in terms of Orange Cassidy trying to at least keep elements of the Orange Cassidy character, but dialing up like a more serious tone here?
Yeah, they've given us like sort of hints of this, you know. I believe even maybe most significantly towards the end of his international title reign, or when he was to win it back from Moxley, in particular. But it's rare, you know. And in this instance, I think this is the biggest, the loudest we've heard an Orange Cassidy, and certainly maybe with the added element of him actually taking a leadership role. So I thought it was like, you know, it amounted to like a good classic babyface promo from Orange Cassidy. It's novel still to just hear him project with the booming voice, and he sounds pretty good doing it. The content of the promo I thought was just okay. You know, Orange Cassidy. What I like about it is that he's realizing that he needs to step up in order to protect the future of AEW, and he wants to do it alone to make sure nobody else gets hurt. He is assuming the role of protector for the company, and that is novel. That is new. Where I get a bit lost is where he said, you know, if Moxley had his way, there wouldn't be no AEW. And I, you know, in just hearing what Moxley has said in all of his promos, I don't get the sense that that's what John Moxley wants. I always assumed that Moxley wanted to replace maybe AEW's current crop of talent with perhaps something new. He wants to replace them with talents that are hungrier, the talents that are have the same drive and motivation that he had. So I never got the sense that he wanted to destroy AEW and leave nothing in its place. So I did, for me, sense a little bit of disconnect between what Cassidy was saying and what I think I've heard from Moxley so far, what I would hear from Moxley later on in this particular show itself. I think a lot of that, though, is perhaps due to the fact that we still don't exactly know what Moxley is after, or, you know, they're purposely keeping it vague, but it makes it really hard for, like, baby faces like, you know, an Orange Cassidy to give us maybe a philosophical promo that might make logical sense to counter what Moxley is actually after.
Yeah, and perhaps it could have just been, you know, John Moxley wants his vision to override AEW, and that doesn't make it AEW. Like, this is there's nothing wrong with this company that John Moxley sees as resting on its laurels or needing to change it into John Moxley's grapple fuck.
Orange should acknowledge that there are faults with the current AEW. It's not perfect, but there are a lot of guys here that just need maybe, I don't know, some push and some adjusting. But then Moxley would counter and say, that's what I'm doing. I'm pushing guys like you, Orange Cassidy, to reach your potential. I wanted a bit more of that philosophical debate, and I felt that was a little kind of missing here from Orange.
Renee chatted with Mercedes and Camille, pumping up her match with Chris Statlander coming up later. She was Renee asked her if Mercedes has a prediction for the match, and Monet called it a terrible question, which it kind of was.
I mean, it's clear.
I don't know. Statlander's, they're building her up for it was the pay-per-view. Awful, I think she'll beat Camille tonight.
It was an awful question. But it didn't feel like it was, it didn't feel like Renee at all. Like, you know, like Renee and none of, like, AEW is the promotion where their announcers don't ask stupid questions. Yeah. And this just kind of felt like it was a segment where they were scripting Renee to ask something stupid just so Monet could respond the way she did.
That's what it felt like. Yeah. Yeah, like
it didn't feel true to, I think, even the Renee character, because, you know, like, yeah, you argue like Renee doesn't have a character. I would argue everybody has one.
Adam Cole, his first match since September of 2023, comes out to take on Buddy Matthews, and Excalibur and Matt Menard have a big discussion about Adam Cole clearly having new wrestling boots and the troubles of adapting to new wrestling boots because he has to reinforce the ankle. So we got a big dissection here of these boots. So early on, Adam Cole has the opening to hit the super kick, but he pulls up and won't do it, and the crowd oohs at this. And then Cole is on the apron, and he hops to the floor to avoid a strike, and his ankle buckles, and he's selling the ankle. And we see Kyle O'Reilly backstage, and this leads to Matthews attacking him, and the idea that the ankle is very compromised, and it's never going to be at 100%. So Matthews ends up attacking the ankle, targets it, stomps it repeatedly on the steps, and Michael Sampson comes to check on Adam Cole. So he's down on the ground as Sampson's checking on him. Bryce is there. The crowd starts counting to 10 since he's on the floor, and Bryce has to, no, the counts don't count. This is a timeout. It's like, well, what changes this from a countout? I mean, the man's down on the floor, but this Bryce clearly did not want this count to be extended by the audience.
It's clearly something they weren't expecting, and I don't think I would have in a million years expected it either. I also would not have expected this crowd to be so pro Buddy Matthews. They were chanting Buddy, 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 and I don't know if it was at the start of this match or if it was somewhere in between, but it was very concerning for me because this was Adam Cole's first match back in like, you know, a year and a half or something.
It happened in the main event too. They were all chanting for MVP.
But they were turning on Adam Cole in favor of Buddy Matthews. So that was pretty shocking for me to see.
So Cole is then being helped to the back, and Matthews gets on the mic calling him fragile and that the new Adam Cole is a little bitch. So Adam Cole turns around and hobbles his way back in and ends up luring Buddy into a super kick and hits it, but then goes for the boom and his leg collapses and gets hit by a curb stomp and kicks out at 2. So Buddy is telling him to throw in the towel. throw in the towel on yourself. I don't even know how that would work. Like, where do you throw the towel?
Don't know if you can.
Yeah. So Cole attacks him, hits a Shining Wizard, and then there's a Panama Sunrise attempt that gets turned into a Buckle Bomb and Curb Stomp follow-up where Cole kicks out at one. And then we go to MJF, apparently in his home, and we had a camera just locked on this guy.
Yeah, well, we established this last week, didn't we? You know, when he was getting massaged in what appeared to be his dimly lit, like, lair. I think we've
maybe gotten... we'll explain. He was live streaming. He was live streaming
in like you know, a film quality like projection camera. Like it was.
Yeah, he also looked to be living at like Casa Loma or something.
Yeah, I mean, I guess you know, maybe there's some attempt at a joke there, but clearly they're getting away from maybe this sort of logical caring about like the invisible camera and everything. Like, we just happen to have a film camera set up at the MJF house as he's watching this particular match via satellite somehow.
Yeah. Can't say this cutaway was all like absolutely necessary either. Like, it
wasn't. No.
But anyway, so then a Panama Sunrise, Matthews rolls to the floor. So Cole leaps off the apron with a follow-up Panama Sunrise on the floor, and then the boom to win in 15 minutes and 28 seconds. Certainly like a divergent reaction from the crowd that I wasn't expecting. I really did like the ankle stuff, though, because it's an injury that all these fans know how serious this was. And the fact that it came off such a routine activity, like hopping off the stage, like as we talked about a week or two ago when he came off and you literally did see him limping. Every fan, when he jumps off that apron, people are going to be thinking about this injury, and you are constantly going to bring people in to buy the ankle story in any of his big matches.
I think for a babyface, like, a significant injury is sort of a storytelling gift, you know, that you could use for all of your matches, at least, you know, as part of like a current run coming off of an injury. Yeah, I thought all of that was done really well. They did a great job of telling the Adam Cole sort of struggling with confidence story via this ankle injury. And I thought Buddy Matthews did a great job playing, you know, essentially this sort of like monster bully trying to take advantage of it. And boy, did the guy look huge, okay?
Dude, like, Buddy Matthews is like the size of the Wolstein Center. He looked just built his own arena called the Swolstein Center.
Ooh, very nice, John. Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if he'd qualify for 205 Live these days. This guy might be more of a 305 Live type of wrestler. But, you know, in contrast, listen, like, it's so sad, you know, being somebody who doesn't look like Buddy Matthews on this roster, because Adam Cole gets a lot of criticism for his body size and his body shape. And, you know, being next to a Buddy Matthews is going to emphasize some of those, I guess, like, awful comments. At the same time, I actually felt like it was very fitting for this particular match where he was trying to be the underdog, trying to be the guy who was struggling with his confidence up against this like big monster, you know, like a superhuman, it almost like it looks like in Buddy Matthews. So I thought it worked out really well for the story. And but there is something I think they should be concerned about with Cole, though, you know, getting this sort of reaction off the top. I tend to think that the more you see a bit of his heel edge come back, framed within a babyface character, like you kind of saw towards the end of this match where he was like embracing some of the sort of cheating elements of the match, I think some of that will dissipate.
Yeah, we'll get into this when we get to the Cole promo. But Kyle O'Reilly is showing nodding in approval backstage after Cole's win. And Cole thanks Buddy for reminding him who the real Adam Cole is. They shake hands. The lights go out. And then the lights come on. And suddenly Malakai Black is shaking his hand. This was just bizarre. But this will be our match for next week.
How? What do you mean it's bizarre? Okay. Like, you know, Buddy Matthews vaporized and in his place teleported.
If you were shaking someone's hand, okay, and the lights go out and that person disengages from the handshake, would you just keep your hand up?
No, the point is that there was no disengagement, okay? Like, Adam Cole, for all we know, just like he was shaking the same hand, it just happened to be now attached to a different person.
Okay, well,
it's magic.
Yeah, this was magic. So this is going to be match number two in Cole's three match series that I have no idea what's going on with this.
He has to win three straight, or the first person to win to get to three wins gets the match with MJF.
Okay, more on this when we get to the Cole promo. Daniels is with Private Party, and I really like this segment where he brings up that him and Kazarian, this is how they had to stop teaming together when they were in the same situation against the Young Bucks, and it was never the same between us afterwards. Now Kazarian doesn't even work here anymore. Let's just make that part of the story. They broke up, and Kazarian left for TNA. We'll skip the other couple of years in between.
I totally forgot.
Private Party state that history will not be repeated tonight. They will win the tag titles. Michael Cole was not on this show, but Adam Cole was, and he was in Doc Samson's trainer's room with the Undisputed Kingdom flanking him, and he says that the match with Matthews was one of the toughest of his career, and he thinks that Malakai Black is going to be next, which the graphic would confirm, yes, it would be, and he admits his ankle may never be the same, and I don't blame MJF for my injury, nor should he.
Yeah.
Like
he didn't make well.
You
I mean,
came down to the ring.
Yeah, but he went. He did it to save MJF.
Okay. He also won't blame him for not checking up on him, but does blame him for thinking that they could be friends. Like what? I blame you for thinking we could be friends. We are meant to be enemies. So quit kidding yourself that you weren't going to betray me. Just like you did Wardlow, Sammy Guevara, and Daniel Garcia. And I wasn't going to sit and wait for that to happen. And what we did to you might have been extreme, but it needed to be done because I care about AEW. I care about the locker room, and I care about the fans. MJF has never been part of that team, and I want to get my hands on you at Full Gear, or... He looks at Roderick. Both of us will get our hands on you. I was so confused. And none of this holds up to the basic level of any storyline recollections that you may have. These guys tore up this locker room in the lead up to the devil. Like they were murdering these people. MJF was the one out there defending his tag titles with you and then coming back later on pay-per-views to wrestle while injured after that one angle. Remember they attacked him in the opener and then he had to come back in the main event to defend his title?
I don't remember.
It was bad.
I trust you.
This, like, let's just move on. They're feuding. Let's stop trying to tie a bow on this very... like completely illogical breakup that they have had. Because honestly, Wei, and I do feel that there is a detriment to this, because any fan that is actually remembering this program, of course, like Adam Cole does come off like the asshole in this. MJF does not.
Yeah.
So I think like that I think is part of, you know, if tonight was maybe just an isolated reaction, is like to anyone, like this was only a year ago and MJF was very much the sympathetic one who had the audience was behind.
Yeah, yeah. So they had two choices this week, okay? They could have just proceeded with this storyline and not made mention of anything in the past again. And this is what they ended up choosing. I sense that they could tell from the reaction to Cole's promo last week that certain audiences were not satisfied with the explanation.
Well, this did wonders.
And this week, they decided to just add another coat of paint over top of this ugly wallpaper and tried to flesh out their explanation. And, you know, I'll give them credit because, like, John, before I heard you recap it, I felt like I kind of enjoyed this because Cole's delivery was so strong. Like I thought he tried to explain this like crazy material about as well as he could, to the point where like you kind of wanted to like clap for it afterwards. But hearing you recap it just now, just like the pure facts of it in your
are you telling me I would have been a horrible wrestling promo?
Well, you're sort of like you provide the code for me to see clearly, you know, without like being just kind of swayed by this man's like charms, right? And like when you spell it out like that, it is completely fucking stupid, you know, what this guy was trying to say. But
well, maybe nobody was actually writing this promo down, and they just listened to his delivery, because I was like, my head was spinning, and then he throws in the idea that maybe you, me and Roddy will get our hands on him. I'm like, this whole three match thing, it's one of you gets him. Like there's I don't know why Roderick Strong is so attached to this this story. Other than it should be Cole and Roderick at the end in match number three.
That's probably exactly the reason, you know, so we can get Strong turning on Cole. They are struggling with at least their attachment to the past with this. I think everybody just doesn't want them to mention it ever again.
Let's just move on. Kyle Fletcher and Don Callis are out, and he calls out Will Ospreay, but instead it's the returning Mark Davis, who refuses a hug from Fletcher and explains that, you know, Ospreay's laid up at home after you attacked him. So I don't even know who I'm looking at anymore. And Fletcher now sees Ospreay for who he really is because of Don Callis. And he used Aussie Open to further his own career. And Fletcher says that Davis has a spot here in the family. Davis says, we had an empire. Why do I need a family? And Kyle, you destroyed it. So Fletcher, as Davis walks off, Fletcher was like, you know, in time, you're going to have to make a very hard decision. And Shivani kind of just said what we were all saying. I think he's decided. I think this is very clear. He is not weighing his options here. He's being very forthright here. But yes, this was our return of Mark Davis. And as John Cena used as his subheading in his report, Aussie closed.
Very good, John Cena. Now, did this feel like an actual return for Mark Davis to you, or was this just more of a nice, you know, like Mark Davis has to come in to provide some sort of like narrative, content, but what Fletcher's saying, someday soon you'll have to make a decision. Does that mean he's not cleared? How did you read this?
Well, I would say that the value of this is Kyle Fletcher attacking Mark Davis, but I wouldn't have done it this way if you are leading to that, where it should be Mark Davis coming back and you're at least left with the tease of whether he is going to join or not, and then you do his big decision. But they kind of laid it out here, and for Mark Davis just to come back and then what, they do a beatdown at that point?
Well, I mean, we saw this Wheeler Yuta segment, haven't we? Like, you know, just because you don't make a decision one week doesn't mean you can't go back and join up with a heel, you know, another week afterwards. So, yeah, I don't know. I think we got a sense of hearing Mark Davis cut a promo here, and he's on a much bigger stage than when he left, you know, because Kyle Fletcher has advanced so much now to the point where Kyle Fletcher is like, you might make an argument that he's one of the top up and coming heels of this entire company. And Mark Davis, when he left, he was just another tag team guy. So having to come out here to oppose one of the top up and coming heels in this company, he had to really take a step up. And it makes you wonder, maybe from hearing this, what his actual level's at, but you know, we haven't heard enough to be able to say, but he does have a great built-in storyline, you know, which is potential for him to maybe raise his stock up to a similar level to Kyle Fletcher. So let's see if he has the skill to take advantage of that opportunity.
Yeah. Whenever you're out of action that long, I don't know if the hoodie undershirt combo is the look.
No, what would be a better look?
Not a hoodie.
Man, this looks like he's got a stain on this shirt.
Yeah, I know. I think it might be a shadow, but you're right. There might be just around the right armpit.
Well,
there
he's just setting up the glow up that he'll eventually get when he turns fully heel.
Okay.
Yeah.
So BCC are on their way out to the ring. They state that Chuck Taylor is recuperating. And Moxley says one day...
A little Hangman promo in here, too.
Oh, that's right. We had the Hangman promo with Renee, where he goes over the history of him and Jay White, explaining that in the Owen Hart tournament, I took you out, not Christian. I'm the reason you got injured. And yes, you beat me at WrestleDream, so now I'm 4-1 against you. So for Paige, there is no such thing as redemption. Only wins and losses and the consequences that follow. So, Jay, I know you're going to come after my leg, but you don't know my strategy. I might light your house on fire, and I might break your ankle again, which might be the first time that we have identified the injury that Jay White was out of action with for all this time.
Hmm. Hmm.
And he will hurt him at Full Gear.
We'll see. We'll see. Does he know where Jay White lives?
Yeah, and I mean, probably multiple residences that he has in various countries.
So. He's already gotten away with arson once.
Well, you know what? Second time, you might not be so lucky. Now BCC is out, and Moxley explains that one day you will understand what we are trying to do. Moxley says, Orange, you didn't challenge me. I challenge you. I challenged you when I broke your friend's neck, not vice versa. So he doesn't want Cassidy to fall under the spell of so many in AEW who are fat and happy with their contracts. So he agrees to face him at Full Gear, and they are not going to fight on the mountaintop, but rather in the valley where he is willing to die. Battle in the valley. Maybe this was earmarked for New Japan Strong in January. Mm-hmm. And then to prove who is pulling the strings, they grab Wheeler Yuta and they put a chair around Yuta's neck, and they are ready to sacrifice Yuta when they draw out Orange Cassidy, who runs down, is outnumbered, and is beaten to a pulp. And Yuta joins in on the attack. So this guy is just, he's a willing sacrificial lamb and knows where his place is at the bottom of the food chain here.
Well, he's so committed to, I guess, the ideology that he's shocked in the moment, but then he realizes, oh yeah, thank you guys for using me. Like, he's just that, like, sort of, I guess he's drinking the Kool-Aid that hard, that much.
So they place Orange Cassidy's neck into a chair when all of a sudden Darby rappels from the rafters. And he just comes down and crashes on the floor, and there's a huge reaction for him. And this had not been like a super excitable crowd, but for this, they really reacted big to this particular return. He attacks Leo Rush, Top Flight get involved, then Daniel Garcia and Private Party. I don't know what it is about Daniel Garcia and Private Party. They are always late to the party during these run-ins. Like, they are always the last to show up.
Maybe they just have like really far away locker rooms.
Okay. And then this kind of bleeds into our tag title match, because the Young Bucks come out and Private Party are already out there for the tag title match, which we're going to get into next.
Yeah. I really like the segment. You know, Mox's promo, despite still being pretty vague and mysterious about his motivations, he sounds so intense saying these things that you buy and trust that he actually has a really great reason for doing all of this in his mind. And I also think he actually does say enough here. You know, he's warring against complacency in the next generation of this locker room, and he's using violence to motivate people like Cassidy to reach their potential. I think that that much is clear. We just don't exactly know who he's doing it for or specifically why he thinks this is so important. I thought the Darby return was great, you know, like giving him the Sting rappel spot. I personally like it a lot. I also love the Bucks taking advantage of this in order to have their match. I think that's such great heel heat. You know, these are the EVPs, and not only are they neglecting to do anything about this BCC, they're actually using it to their advantage. And by doing this for a match where the other team is putting their tag team careers on the line, I just love the way that they started this one.
Yeah, they come out and we get right into it. And the first big thing, first of all, Private Party hit a poetry in motion to the floor. And then Quinn stops Matt from using the ring bell and swings the ring bell, missing Matt, who ducks, and he nails Zay with the ring bell, causing Zay to get busted open. So he would be bleeding throughout the match. And Matt is ramming Zay's head into the steps. And then the Bucks control Quinn in their corner while Zay is recovering. And when Quinn finally tagged Brother Zay, this place went nuts for this hot tag. And Private Party are in with their own super kicks, stereo 450s. And then the Bucks come back with their pendulum powerbomb. We got a chant of tag team wrestling from this crowd. And then Nick boots Quinn off the shoulders of Matt onto the floor, and they drag him up to the entrance when Okada Okada comes out and hits a tombstone, and you're left to forget about Mark Quinn. So they double team Brother Zay with their own version of Gin and Juice, but Zay manages to kick out. Then they hit him with super kicks. Zay continues to kick out. This guy was like the greatest babyface here. So now it's time for the EVP trigger, but Zay collapses. So they try it again, but this time Zay ducks, so they crash knees, and he gets the inside cradle for a near fall, and then a roll up by Zay, but he's knocked into the ropes where Nick nails him, and that sets up the EVP trigger. And when, first of all, my stream ended here on my end, so I had to refresh my window, and the chat comes up, which God forbid you ever read the chat.
You're talking about the Triller
chat. The Triller chat, and
it's awful.
So I just see the one comment of like, it was like, rest in peace, Private Party. So I'm like, okay, well, Private Party are losing this match. So I'm watching this final sequence with the idea that Private Party are losing. So the chat actually added to the drama of this whole thing. So he kicks out of the EVP trigger, and then we get the inside cradle. And then he kicks out of the EVP trigger, and Nick then hits a V trigger, followed by Matt with a one-winged angel. And I'm thinking completely, this should be the finish. When Mark Quinn dived from the floor into the ring, this was the greatest save. This came out of nowhere. This crowd's going insane. And then they hit the Poison Rana to Matt and the Gin and Juice on Nick, and they win in 18 minutes and 7 seconds. I thought this match was so incredible. I just thought this was one of the better TV matches that AEW... Yes, there has been some... athletically, like some superior matches, but just in terms of just these baby faces, you got the big win at the end. This is probably the best Private Party match I have seen. I thought this was just an outstanding performance by these four.
Yeah. I think the Bucks are pretty much always great in these tag team matches, but I think they are at their very, very best when they have a juicy story to work with. And this sort of tag career stipulation certainly provided that for this type of match. I thought they did such a great job of putting Private Party at a disadvantage throughout the entire thing. So you really felt the stakes of that particular stipulation. I love the friendly fire ring bell spot, that especially because it took place so early in the match, because it allowed Zay to essentially work the entirety of this entire match half dead. And you really got into him because, again, you knew what was at stake here. The team was going to break up, and here you are dealing with this guy who's already severely handicapped here. Not only was Zay half dead, he also had great reason to be resentful to his tag team partner as well. And I think it adds to the story that they've been building that Zay feels he, or Zay questions that he might be better off by himself and without being inside this tag team. So they've been very consistent with the story. It was Zay himself who suggested putting their tag titles on the line without consulting Quinn first. So I think all of that played into this match really well with that ring bell spot. Meanwhile, like Quinn, you actually feel a lot of sympathy for, because he feels like he's a guy who might be left behind at the end of all of this. You can tell, like, he fucked up again. Like, he is the Jannetty of the group. Like, he is somebody who should be doubting himself because he might be holding Zay back. And then the Bucks just did such a great job of just continuing to put that pressure on in a 2-on-1 advantage, gave us this incredible survival performance from Isaiah Cassidy, but, you know, who managed to survive long enough so that Quinn could come in, make the save, and shows that he's not the Jannetty of the group. He's able to be a great tag team partner, made the save. They did their double team moves. Just great, great, great storytelling here in a match that certainly helps elevate Private Party to that next level. I definitely think it's, you know, the best Private Party match I've seen. One of the best Bucks matches I've seen in a very long time as well.
Yeah, this was just, I thoroughly enjoyed this match. I thought it was so great. And again, like, and we'll see this in like the next match. Again, this was not just a red hot crowd from start to finish. So when they really got them in this match, I thought it was extra impressive because they were going nuts for all these big near falls and some of the high points of the match. So I just thought it was really well done. The Bucks ripped the belts away from Private Party before handing them over and putting them on their shoulders, and they leave the ring with Private Party celebrating. Renee then talks to Jamie Hayter and Penelope Ford, who will have their match next week. And wouldn't you know it, they agreed to no physicality before they face each other next week. So Ford, she's been here since day one. People have forgotten about me. God damn it. I put skewers in my head. And Jamie Hayter, who's definitely got the most interesting fashion sense in this company.
What do you mean? She's dressed as Scooby-Doo.
She was dressed like Scooby-Doo last week. I don't think this is a Halloween costume.
Oh, you don't think so? You don't think this is...
I truly don't believe this is a costume.
You don't think this is the purple, the chick who wears purple with the green handkerchief, Daphne on Scooby-Doo?
Look at some of her outfits. This is definitely in line with like her new wardrobe since returning. So.
Okay. I don't know about this one, though. This is a pretty dead ringer.
Well, I think a lot of people last week when they saw her made this comparison, and maybe this informed her to lean into it a bit more for Halloween. Okay. We'll meet in the middle maybe, here, okay? Maybe. But wait till you see future iterations of this. So anyway, she's going to mop the floor with Penelope Ford. That's next week. Video for Swerve and Benjamin, and then the Learning Tree is out. And Chris Jericho notes that the ladder match last week was noted by the Wrestling Observer newsletter to be a ladder match that will be remembered for a long, long time, generating 4 stars from Dave Meltzer. And he became a two-time ROH champion, just like Jay Briscoe. He then took credit for quarterbacking Terrifier 3, and that AEW became a powerhouse because of me, with all due respect to Jon Moxley. And I will do the same for ROH, taking it to its biggest stage ever. And to underestimate me means you overestimate your knowledge and understanding of the television and pro wrestling business. So is Chris Jericho going to secure a media rights deal for Ring of Honor?
I mean, this seems to be maybe what they're teasing, you know. Could it be a lead up to that? Why else would you put the ROH title on Chris Jericho again?
Oh my gosh, the ROH Jericho version. Jericho just gets control of ROH, and he gets to run it.
I mean, would many AEW fans complain, I guess, if, you know, he was kept on that island, and an island that could use him?
Well, I mean, the title is on him to be the focus of ROH, and it's at a time when they're shopping this around, and they could certainly weave this into storyline where this is Chris Jericho elevating this brand in his image. Video on Anna Jay, kind of going through her ROH or her AEW career, going back to 2020, and then going to Japan, where she knew she needed some things to change and has come back from Japan. Now she is ready to be women's champion and gets her title match on Saturday. Marvez tries to speak with the Young Bucks and is stopped by Jack Perry, who is confronted by Daniel Garcia. And then Perry opens up the Elite's dressing room, where the Bucks and Brandon Cutler are furiously shredding documents like this was the Watergate scandal.
Yeah. I don't know what to make of this. I just know that, like, when he opened the door and we're seeing the scene of the Bucks panicking as Brandon Cutler is shredding documents, and Okada is just, like, chilling in the background like he's got nothing to do with this and doesn't care at all. I found it hilarious. So what can we assume about this storyline, okay? And what does it have to do with losing the tag team championships, all right? So this is what, like, some sort of... I don't know. They were trying to tell some sort of like takeover story. Did holding the championship somehow protect them in some way from having to reveal the contents of these documents? What is in the contents of these documents that had them panicking so much? And how did losing the tag titles cause this?
There's definitely, like, this storyline is definitely near the front of my short list for worst of the year. I think this angle's been awful, and I feel when I saw documents being destroyed, I was like, at least this is going to be entertainingly bad.
Well, I think that this is, like, what the Bucks are essentially, like, it's the type of comedy that they just kind of produce, right? This feels like it's a BTE type of thing, right? Like, they're not EVPs.
But there's no BTE to explain this.
Well, I mean, like, it's just sort of the tone that they always seem to have with, like, their content. It's, they're very funny. Like, but as EVPs, you can't buy them as a threatening group, because I think so much of what they do is just kind of, like, you know, like, blended with, like, absurd comedy. And I get the sense, like, this is something to that effect. Whether or not we ever find the contents of the documents, or if this was just, like, meant to be a one-week psych gag, I guess we'll find out in subsequent weeks.
Maybe we're going to learn there was a Freedom of Information Act request made towards the elite, and now they're destroying documents on camera, no less.
I guess so. But what does losing the tag titles have to do with it?
Wait, I really don't know. I have no idea. I'm so confused. The strongest ending to that tag title match was the idea that by the end of it, I was like, okay, getting the Young Bucks back as baby faces is probably a positive at this stage right now. I think that that is the direction we are going here.
Not until you get the Kenny match. I mean, you know.
Well, you have the whole Kenny thing that could certainly delay that.
Yeah, like especially like in their closing scene here, they were clearly still playing chicken shit EVPs.
Okay. Maybe this is all there. I have no idea, but I don't have high hopes for where this goes. Camille against Chris Statlander was next. They went about 6.5 minutes, where Statlander is draped on the rope and Monet goes to hit her with her shoe and gets caught by the ref. And no penalty here. So she should have just blasted her with the shoe. Like, just get the shot in. Camille landed a pump kick out of the corner. Camille looks very just tentative. That's what I'm going to say. Mm-hmm. Like, it just
seems she's lacking in confidence.
I think so. And I think she got a lot of like negativity over last week's match. And it just feels as a, and this week, like last week's match was like 2 minutes. This one was 6.5. It just feels like everything, you can almost see like the wheels turning as she's going from one thing to the next.
Yeah. I mean, it could still be nerves. But like as a giant, if you don't have confidence, if you don't like you're somebody who's there to destroy and hurt people, then that's unfortunately a killer. And you know, for somebody who's been in the industry for as long as she has, I think there are higher expectations for the level that, she should be at.
Camille did the radio silence and then a torture rack into a blue thunder bomb. That was her big near fall, and then lifted Statlander for the tombstone that is reversed into Wednesday Night Fever. And Chris Statlander, the first one to beat Camille, and certainly leads to Monet and Statlander. Monet jumps Statlander from behind and sends Camille to the back and states, if you want to do something done right, you do it yourself. So we're already teasing a breakup here between these two, which feels way too early to be going that direction. I can't say this match was anything special, but it gets you a step towards Statlander and Mercedes.
It was a stronger match from Camille this week than last, which I guess isn't saying a whole lot because last week wasn't that great. But I thought her moves looked good, and like maybe there's still enough here with like that you could say that there's potential. But she still, I think, has a long way to go from being a finished product. You know, confidence and fluidity just aren't really there. And again, a little bit concerning considering how long she's been doing it. But that doesn't mean people can't have incredible turnarounds with the right coaching, with the right storyline, with the right character. So let's see how committed they are with her. I have not been impressed with Mercedes Moné's mic work, and it's unfortunate because like she wrestles so infrequently now that she only has her mic work to rely on, and it is still the worst part of her game. They were teasing a Stokely interaction or MVP involvement, I should say. She really needs somebody like that as a mouthpiece.
The patriarchy invited Hook to speak next week so Christian can explain himself. And then Renee is with Briscoe, Kyle O'Reilly, and Tomohiro Ishii. And Briscoe cuts a promo on Jericho, stating that he's not stable and you must not care about your health for uttering Jay's name and what I'm going to do to you. So he issues a challenge for a fight without honor with the three of them against the Learning Tree that's going to happen next Wednesday. The Bucks are making a beeline out of the arena, and Daniels can't believe they're leaving right now and say it's too chaotic. We wanted to change the world, but no one wanted to listen to us, so we're working from home. And Daniels pleads, we need you. and they leave Brandon Cutler behind as he is coming out of the arena and the BCC show up, attack Cutler, and Moxley subdues Daniels as Claudio hammers the hand of Brandon Cutler. And yeah, that's the end of Cutler's hand, and the Young Bucks are going to work from home.
Yeah, you can't shoot video anymore, this guy.
Man. Thankfully, Tony Khan runs this show, so this should be a perfect pivot, and the show should run seamlessly as it did prior.
Yeah, I don't know. There's no, there continues to be no explanation about like why this Moxley group isn't being fined. Like, Chris Daniels just seems powerless at any of.
God forbid that Jamie Hayter and Penelope Ford come to blows, but we'll have dudes with hammers just running wild.
Yeah, it's kind of inconsistent. And you know what? We haven't really had any sort of like real idea of what the extent of Chris Daniels' powers are. Right, like clearly he can't do anything about the Bucks because they're EVPs, but like even with the BCC, he's not really allowed to do anything. You know, I hate to again make these sort of comparisons, but like if in the WWE, I think you have a better understanding of like what a Nick Aldis and what an Adam Pearce can do. And in a situation like this, you would be seeing fines for the BCC, or at least they'd be banned from, you know, appearing for on TV for like a week or something like that. And I don't get the sense we'll get anything like that coming off of this.
They do almost zero physicality with Adam Pearce. Like, you put your hands on him, like that is like that's the angle you do like once every other year. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And like Daniels from the get go. They've just made him like the middle management goof, like yeah. Even with like the silly looking ties, and he just like he's meant to be silly, and that's how they treat him. And this
I don't
is,
think he's meant to be silly. I think he just kind of comes across like that.
Well, in another context, like this could have been a serious angle right here. Like here they are taking the authority figure like yeah. this, and this was nothing on the show.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Support for this post-wrestling podcast comes from those of you who have picked up our merch over at Chopped Tees. T-shirts, hoodies, sweatshirts, and hats from post-wrestling and our network of shows, including the NWA Podcast, Poison Rana, The Long and Winding Royal Road, WrestleNomics, and MCU Later. Free shipping to almost anywhere in the entire world. No minimum spend required. Tag us in a photo of yourself wearing our merch on social media, and I'll even send you a signed postcard while supplies last. That's chopped-tees.com/post-wrestling.
Here is our lineup. So Rampage, they announced Lio Rush and Commander. Saturday's Collision has Mariah May against Anna Jay for the women's title, Thunder Rosa against Harley Cameron in a Day of the Dead match, and Kyle Fletcher against Commander. Next week's Dynamite, well, we went through the lineup already. We have four matches announced so far. Swerve Strickland against Shelton Benjamin is the main event, and the crowd early on, they're chanting for MVP, and MVP even like turns and gives them all a look, and Shelton is in control at the beginning. And he's delivering knees to the body, and Nana and MVP start arguing. Benjamin continues to control. This picked up more later, but I would say, dude, the first half of this match, it was exceptionally slow.
Hmm. Interesting.
You didn't have that reaction?
I mean, I guess I just kind of recognized like the type of story that they were trying to tell with like Shelton Benjamin playing more of like this dominant monster, slow plotting type of like guy who could throw you. Really,
well, it was
well.
Slow and plotting. They achieved that for me at the beginning here. Finally, Swerve comes back and hits the leaping uppercut, rolling flatliner. And then when he goes for the rolling flatliner, it is caught by Shelton into a vertical suplex. And the two meet face to face and get into an exchange, ending with the house call, and follows with a 450 splash that Benjamin kicks out from, but holds on to the waist, turning it into a German. And it did pick up here. Swerve does the rolling flatliner, and then a sit out powerbomb from the corner goes up, Swerve stomp, and he pins Shelton Benjamin. So Swerve, this was his first match since the lights out steel cage match at All Out, and gets the win here. And MVP makes a phone call. And this was an extremely quick response, because all of a sudden the music begins and out walks Bobby Lashley in maybe, okay, if Mark Davis blew the I'm making my return wardrobe, Bobby Lashley nailed it. Okay, dude was wearing leather maroon pants with cowboy boots with maroon, like maroon top to bottom.
Yeah.
This was something else as he came out. And this crowd, they're going nuts here. Gives MVP a big hug, and then he goes face-to-face with Swerve, and the whole crowd is chanting. Swerve gets distracted by Shelton on the apron, and Lashley attacks and puts on the Hurt Lock. Prince Nana gets knocked out, and then we hear one of the production guys on the floor yell, 90 seconds! So they continue. They fight off security. There's like a dozen of them that run in, and the former Hurt Business destroy them all. Excalibur then, this is like minutes later, I think that the phone call was to Bobby Lashley.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Like,
it might have been, yeah. Then we hear the same guy, 30 seconds, as MVP grabs the microphone and says, guess who's back in business? And the show ends, and the production man wiped his brow from the sweat as he was nervous about breaking this overrun. And there you go. That was our conclusion of Dynamite.
Yeah, yeah. Lashley looked great. Absolutely. Like, just big entrance, like, new music, you know, like, good lighting, like, amazing suit. So, like, for guys like him, just, like, they feel like big stars from the moment that they walk out. And I'm really looking forward to this new Hurt Syndicate, Hurt Business, whatever you want to call them. I mean, I really am just so impressed at the work that they've done with Shelton Benjamin. I'm impressed with Shelton Benjamin, period, you know, at how they've been able to refresh him in just like 2 weeks' time. They have made him into this sort of like monster amateur wrestler. And I'm curious to see how he fits in with Bobby Lashley. I think stylistically, he might appear to be like, they should play to his strengths. You know, what can he do that a Bobby Lashley can't? They should make him wrestle different enough so that he has a place in this faction where he's not just perceived as just, you know, the third guy, or I should say second guy next to Bobby Lashley. But I'm glad this group is back together. We'll see if they add any other members. The takeover tone of the closing angle, I guess I didn't really love, because it's coming so close from like what the BCC are doing. Whereas like, security clearly doesn't care about the BCC. It's the wrestlers that care about the BCC, but security for some reason cares about this Hurt Business attacking Prince Nana and Swerve.
Swerve's a higher priority,
I guess,
than Chuck Taylor.
Yeah, yeah. There's definitely, I think, some inconsistency in just like, I don't know what they're trying to convey of like people taking over in this company, you know. But it looks cool.
Well, I mean, at least one of the groups is going to work from home, so you are one less. Well, at least the Bucks are going to work from home.
Yeah.
That was Dynamite. What did you think about the show? Like, there was a lot thrown out on this 2 hour plus edition of the show. I'm going to just get it out. Like, my clear highlight was that tag title match. I just thought that was an incredible match. I thought it was really, really strong.
I would say, as usual with like AEW shows, there are things I really liked and then things I really didn't like. And I think that's kind of what you get with AEW often, where maybe people are just kind of left to their own devices. There's some inconsistency in quality. Some of the things that they do well are really good, and some of the things that are not good are really not good in many cases. So yeah, there was enough to I would say that was here that I would say was worth watching, but there are definitely lowlights. Like, this Adam Cole thing is still, I think, very kind of confusing, and I hope they just kind of move on and forget about the past. Monet and Camille, I'm not really sold on. You know, Private Party was a great match. Yeah.
You're remaining optimistic on what these shredded documents are going to reveal.
I don't know if I'm optimistic or not. I don't really have much opinion either way.
Maybe that was the WBD deal that they had signed, but they hadn't returned the documents yet to David Zaslav, and they just destroyed the television deal.
It could be, yeah. I'm sensing tonight was just maybe a one-off, like, sort of sight gag to show Brandon Cutler shredding documents. But we'll see.
All right, we'll find out. On to
World Series competition will definitely take a big bite out of tonight. But the Dodgers have won the series.
Oh, the series is over. Dodgers win in five. Well, there you have it. They had to play three nights in a row. I think that's it's kind of intense for the World Series.
Yeah, that's pretty crazy.
To go Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. I mean, Jesus, what's Did you watch the from last night's game at Yankee Stadium where the fans got involved?
I didn't watch anything. No, what happened?
It's all over the place. Like these guys were in like they were in the front row, and the ball was coming down, and as the player is trying to grab the ball, they like not only try to take the ball out, but they're grabbing him by the arm and like pretty much assaulting this player. It's don't put your hands on players in any sports or entertainment environment. But yeah, it was quite wild. All right. We are going to go. If you have super chats, we welcome them all. And we have some pieces of feedback before we bid everyone farewell.
Let's go to forum.postwrestling.com.
Up first is Andrew from Cape Breton. A well-structured show. It was great to see them put the tag titles on Private Party. I expected them to be thrown down the card, and I'm glad I was wrong. While AEW has been a heavy heat promotion in recent months, they really needed to have the good guys win this one in the end. I also enjoyed the Adam Cole, Buddy Matthews match. Buddy is someone I wish they would do more with, as he's incredibly underrated. I do like how they're getting things booked in advance, but they should take some extra time to do the classic Excalibur rundown. I've always gushed about it, as it adds to the fast pacing of the show. It felt like they were tripping over themselves to call the match and do the rundown at the same time. I also hope this isn't the end of Shelton Benjamin with Bobby Lashley coming in. I do not think this is going to be the end of Shelton Benjamin at all. Lastly, did they hire John Cena as the timekeeper? He was yelling the time cues at the end of the show so loudly. Yeah, very vocalized cues there from 90 seconds onward.
Yeah, I mean, I'm assuming that every week is sort of like that, but maybe this week just had microphones that were turned up maybe in areas that they usually aren't. I don't know, but yeah, they were definitely noticeable today. Let's go to Brian from New Jersey, who says, I really enjoyed the episode, a considerable step up from last week. I thought the tag title match was outstanding. Orange's opening promo was exactly what it needed to be. Good main event with the quality introduction for Lashley, his first time on TBS, as exclaimed by Tony Schiavone. Darby Allin's return from Papa Sting's old hangout caught me by surprise and enhanced the chaos of that segment. A lot of good storytelling throughout as Full Gear comes together with the main event in place. I don't mind the angle involving the Bucks getting out of here and fully washing their hands of Moxley's chaos, but that attack on Brandon Cutler was a miss, as they should have used a different angle to hide the hammer clearly not hitting his hand. I'm heading to Collision in Philadelphia this Saturday, my first big night out to live wrestling since WrestleMania. Looking forward to seeing more than just three matches advertised so far, though I think those three will deliver.
Well, have that X account on refresh. I'm sure they will add more on Rampage and online before Saturday. But yes, that is it. Overall, like, have you found there to be more of an urgency they've added to these shows by trying to get ahead of things and announce things a week or two in advance? And like, what have you seen, like, where the last few weeks they have ramped up when it comes to promoting these, or have you not sensed much of a change?
I haven't sensed much of a change, you know, but I'm also I think the numbers will tell the biggest, you know, of the success of doing that. I wonder if just simply announcing the date is enough in many of these cases. I wonder if even announcing just matches is enough. I think they need to be enticing matches. I think they need to be like sort of like you need to show people that these are relevant, like story driven or like interesting match driven with relevant stakes attached to those matches types of shows, you know?
Well, that is going to wrap up tonight's edition of Rewind to Dynamite. Way and I are coming back to you on Thursday at postwrestlingcafe.com. It's Rewind Away number 168. And what do we have in store for you? Money in the Bank 2011, a show that is now some 13 years old. CM Punk going for the WWE Championship in his hometown of Chicago against John Cena in the main event. Along with that, two Money in the Bank ladder matches. Brie Bella challenging Kelly Kelly for the Divas title. Big Show versus Mark Henry. All that and more. Randy Orton and Christian for the World Heavyweight Championship. A very well-remembered feud of 2011. So that is coming up on Rewind Away. We will go back to that time period. The WWE's version of the Summer of Punk, the pipe bomb, and how successful this show was. How much did that promo inspire people to buy this show? We will go into whether this was a success and, of course, the short and long-term effects coming out of this for one Phillip Brooks.
Mm-hmm. And later this weekend, of course, we've got our Crown Jewel review that John and I will be doing right after Crown Jewel ends on the free feed here at youtube.com/postwrestling. So join us on Saturday for that. In the evening, we've got Collision Course returning to the Post Wrestling Cafe. And then on Sunday, it'll be the MCU later covering the finale of Agatha All Along. So those of you who are usually expecting that Thursdays, tune in on Sunday for that.
Yes. And Monday night, Wei Ting is going to have a rare night off, so I am going to be joined by Nate Milton on Rewind to Raw. So tune in Monday night as we will be talking about Raw from Saudi Arabia and whatever's happening in the U.S. The next day. So tune into that coming up. All those great shows. We'll speak with you. Again, programming note, no Rewind to SmackDown this Friday because we will be back Saturday. It's a very short turnaround, so we'll speak with you Saturday afternoon and on the cafe Thursday. Goodbye.
With Robinhood Gold, you don't need a silver spoon to eat up the financial favors of the 1%. Robinhood Gold allows the resourceful individual to earn the very liberal rate of 4.5% APY on uninvested cash, receive unlimited 1% deposit bonuses, and be rewarded with a handsome 3% retirement boost on an IRA account. Get the privileges of the high net worth for any net worth for just $5 a month. Sign up at Robinhood.com/gold. Terms apply. For product-specific disclosures, visit Robinhood.com/gold. Investing involves risk. Rate may change. Gold membership is offered by Robinhood Gold LLC.